Hello, everyone. My name is Preston Washington. I'll be one of your commentators this evening. What we have on the schedule is the book, The Abolitionist, by Benjamin Quarles. And what we're going to do, the program format, we're going to listen to Chapter 2, which will be approximately 35 to 40 minutes, and then we'll open up the discussion and commentary. The program tonight is hosted and are produced by Leslie Gist of the Gist of Freedom. And we should be queuing that up any moment now.
Benjamin Quarles, continued. Cassette 1, Side 2.
Good evening. And blessings. And welcome to another installment of the Gist of Freedom Estate. This show is produced by acclaimed historian, educator, and author, Leslie Gist, and serves as our weekly live online discussion to celebrate the African American experience by honoring all the people, past and present, black and white, who, with faith and focus, are preserving our rich history through literature, the arts, the skilled trades, and the humanities. We thank you for joining us tonight, and we'd love you to be a part of tonight's discussion by calling in with your comments or questions to 347-324-5552.
North Carolina to enact laws against incendiary publications and prompted the mayor of Savannah, William T. Williams, and the governor of Georgia, George R. Gilmer, to send letters of protest to the mayor of Boston, Harrison Gray Otis. In February 1830, four Negroes were arrested in New Orleans on the charge of circulating it. Walker's death in 1830 did not diminish the influence of his appeal, Negroes regarding it as an inspired work, and Southern whites viewing it as the diabolical Boston pamphlet. Both would have agreed with their contemporary, Samuel J. May, that the excitement which had become so general and so furious against the abolitionists throughout the slaveholding states was owing in no small measure to David Walker. A much profounder traumatic experience was in store for the South in the Nat Turner insurrection in Tidewater, Virginia, in the late summer of 1831. The revolt was conceived and planned by a slave preacher, Nat Turner, a dedicated revolutionary, but also something of a mystic, torn between a New Testament affirmation of love and an even more consuming Old Testament passion for massive warfare against the satanic hosts, in this instance, slavery. After receiving what he considered a sign from heaven, Turner and his followers set about their grim business, killing some 60 whites. Turner's rebellion, Walker's pamphlet, and the appearance of the new abolitionists did not completely crush anti-slavery sentiment in the South. But they combined to give it a blow from which it could never recover, and they were all but fatal to the organized expressions of anti-slavery sentiment, the hitherto numerous manumission societies. Southern abolitionists could not cope with the massive assault by slavery supporters who could now put them in a class with Walker, Turner, and the new militants, the South's new symbols of outrage, detestation, and fear. The loss of the South as a recruiting ground for abolitionists coincided with the acquisition of a new element, greater in ardor than the lost component, if somewhat below it in formal education and social rank. This new element was the Negro. The grand abolition movement of the day, which is now agitating the northern states, is of a mixed complexion, with a slice of black and a slice of white in somewhat unequal proportions, observed the New York Herald with a typical touch of derision. This new black element made its debut at the same time as, and in close conjunction with, that of the Boston reformer destined to become the movement's best-known name, William Lloyd Garrison. Looking back in 1855, from a vantage of 25 years, J. McCune Smith, the Negro physician and abolitionist, observed that it was hard to tell which loved the other most, Mr. Garrison the colored people, or the colored people Mr. Garrison. This reciprocal sentiment first emerged in Baltimore, where Garrison spent some 8 months during 1829-30, assisting Benjamin Lundy in editing The Genius of Universal Emancipation. The Garrison-Negro bond of affection was sealed upon Garrison's return to Boston to launch The Liberator. Its first issue, dated January 1, 1831, struck the militant note so typical of the new school. He was in earnest, and he would be heard, wrote Garrison. Moreover, he would be as harsh as truth and as uncompromising as justice. The 25-year-old editor had a special message to our free colored brethren, seeking their support and promising them his, inasmuch as we know that you are now struggling against wind and tide. During the early months of 1831, Garrison traveled to half a dozen cities, New York and Philadelphia among them, giving to Negroes a standard speech written with them in mind. In it, he promised to devote his life to their service in order to make atonement for the wrongs done them by persons of his own color. Small wonder, wrote his children, that there were some who took Mr. Garrison for a black man. Partly as a result of his growing familiarity with the Negroes' opinions, Garrison reversed his stand on colonization to make it conform to theirs. It was their united and strenuous opposition to the expatriation scheme that first induced Garrison and others to oppose it, wrote abolitionist Lewis Tappan. Garrison's thoughts on African colonization, published in 1832, was the sharpest and most sustained attack on the American Colonization Society up to that time. Significantly, the entire second half of the small book is devoted to portraying the negative attitude of Negroes toward emigration to Liberia. Garrison's blast changed many minds, doing much to dislodge colonization from the abolitionist movement. The Negro's response to this Daniel come to judgment was immediate and full. As his black townsmen later pointed out, we had good doctrine enough before Garrison, but we wanted a good example. Concrete evidence of this regard for Garrison was the support given to the Liberator. On the day before the first issue was scheduled to appear, James Fortin sent the money for 27 subscriptions, a $54 windfall that enabled Garrison and his publishing associate, Isaac Knapp, to buy the necessary ream of paper. I seriously question whether there would ever have been a Liberator printed, wrote Garrison later, had it not been for that timely remittance. 5 weeks later, Fortin sent $20 for additional subscriptions. For the first three crucial years, the majority of the paper subscribers were Negroes. In April 1834, whites comprised only one quarter of the 2,300 subscribers. The early Liberator had a core of Negro agents, including, as of February 1832, Richard Johnson in nearby New Bedford, Jehiel C. Beeman in Middletown, Connecticut, Abraham D. Shadd in Wilmington, Philip A. Bell in New York City, Josiah Green in upstate Rochester, John Peck in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, and John B. Vachon in Pittsburgh. A veteran of the War of 1812 and a barber with his own shop, Vachon was Garrison's chief benefactor during the Liberator's first years. In December 1832, Vachon sent Garrison $50, which the latter preferred to consider a loan. 11 months later, when Vachon sent $60, the grateful Garrison expressed the wish that it be considered only an extension of the loan. Garrison was less inclined to demur when a Negro group in Boston sent $30 for life membership in the recently organized New England Anti-Slavery Society for him and his publishing associate, Isaac Knapp. Money furnished by Negroes enabled Garrison to take his first trip abroad. In the spring of 1833, Garrison decided to go to England for the threefold purpose of spreading the new gospel of freedom, raising money for a Negro manual labor school, and upsetting the fundraising efforts of Elliot Cresson of the American Colonization Society. Garrison had no money for the trip, but his Negro admirers took up collections, raising nearly $400. Individual gifts ranged from 50 cents to $5. And group gifts from $4 to $124. Some groups, such as the Colored Female Religious and Moral Society of Salem, sent bon voyage presents. On the eve of embarkation, he was presented a silver medal by the Juvenile Garrison Independent Society, a group of colored youth pursuing virtue and knowledge in Boston. When Garrison, after 4 months in England, prepared to return to America, he was again without funds. This time he turned to Nathaniel Paul, a Negro Baptist clergyman then traveling in the British Isles to raise money for the Wilberforce settlement in Canada. Paul advanced Garrison $200 so that I could return home without begging, as he phrased it in a letter to Lewis Tappan. Upon his return to Boston, his Negro admirers held a public reception at Marlborough Chapel, presided over by John T. Hilton, fraternal leader and reformer. Negroes sought to protect Garrison from bodily harm. Fearing that he might be waylaid by enemies, they followed him late at night whenever he walked the 3 miles from his office to his Roxbury home, Freedom's Cottage. These unsolicited protectors were armed with cudgels. Therefore, it was just as well that Garrison, a non-resistant, was unaware of their services. Negroes were powerless, however, to prevent the daytime mobbing of Garrison on October 21, 1835, when he was led through the streets of downtown Boston with a rope around his middle. Put in jail for safekeeping, Garrison was visited by John B. Vachon, who brought him a new hat at a venture as to the precise size required. The pair of pants which had been torn off Garrison became the prized possession of William H. Logan, who solicited them from the sheriff. At noon on the day of the riot, Vachon had dined at Garrison's home. In turn, Garrison often dined at the homes of Negroes. While on a visit to Portland, Maine in September 1832, he was driven around on a sightseeing tour by Reuben Ruby, and entertained at Ruby's home in company with 20 Negroes invited to meet him. While in Philadelphia, Garrison might dine with James Fortin or James McCrummel, and in Albany with the tailor, William Topp. While in New York for the historic meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society in May 1840, Garrison stayed with Thomas Van Rensselaer, without money and without price. James G. Barbados, a fellow townsman and clothing store owner, named a son after Garrison. David Walker's boy was christened Edward Garrison Walker. Negro societies in Boston and New York bore the name Garrison in their titles. The Negro painter, Robert Douglas Jr., completed a lithographic portrait of Garrison, copies of which sold for 50 cents to further the cause. Meeting in mid-July 1831 in the African school room of the two-story brick meeting house in Belknap Street, a group of Boston Negroes took note of Garrison's unstinted exertions on their behalf, viewing him as greatly commanding their thanks and gratitude. The man they so honored hardly seemed of Hall of Fame caliber. Certainly in appearance he was not impressive. Prematurely bald and wearing steel-rimmed glasses, he looked mild and benign, with a touch of the funereal in his dress, customarily a black suit and a black cravat. As a speaker, he tended to become monotonous. He had a penchant for strong epithets, which his associate, Lydia Maria Child, attributed to his being very thoroughly imbued with the phraseology of the Bible, and he was overly quick to charge an opponent with moral blindness or a lack of integrity. He was untidy in his ideas, and his grasp of history, law, and politics was slight. But whatever the catalogue of his shortcomings, his unswerving championship of human rights marked him as a providential figure in an age when the forces of slavery and anti-slavery met head-on in America. This confrontation was welcomed by the latter-day abolitionists, with young leadership, some of it Garrison's, and with new blood, some of it the Negroes. Chapter 2. Black Sowers of the Word. Now, under the elevated and cherishing influence of the American Anti-Slavery Society, the colored race, like the white, furnishes Corinthian capitals for the noblest temples. Maria Weston Chapman, 1843. The new spirit of abolitionism received its widest expression in the formation of the American Anti-Slavery Society at Philadelphia on December 4, 1833. The 63 delegates from 11 states proclaimed as their twin objects the entire abolition of slavery in the United States and the elevation of the character and condition of the people of color. Three Negroes took part in the proceedings: James McCrummel, Robert Purvis, and James G. Barbados. The Negroes of Carlisle, Pennsylvania, had sent as their representative a white man whom they had swung over to the abolition cause, J. Miller McKim, destined to be a stalwart in the movement for more than a quarter of a century. No public gathering of abolitionists was more memorable than this three-day organizational meeting at Adelphi Hall. The sessions had to be confined to the shortening daytime hours at the insistence of the city fathers. The police authorities feared an outbreak of violence, and indeed the delegates were taunted as they made their way along Walnut Street to the entrance of the hall. Disorder inside the building was also a distinct possibility, inasmuch as no one was refused admission, although the doors were locked once the meeting was called to order. But more than threats would have been required to deter the earnest and able group, a plainly dressed, if youngish-looking, band of reformers. At one of the sessions on the morning of Thursday, December 5th, the presiding officer was James McCrummel of Philadelphia. But his fellow townsman, Robert Purvis, was the most observed of the Negro trio at the convention. Soon to marry the daughter of James Fortin, but independently wealthy of inheritance from his white merchant father, Purvis could be depended upon to make his presence felt in a public gathering. 40 years later, John Greenleaf Whittier could still remember his initial impression of Purvis at Philadelphia. "I think I have never seen a finer face and figure, and his manner, words, and bearing were in keeping. Who is he?" I asked. Purvis himself did not feel that he was at his best, confessing that his heart was too full for his tongue. But he did add, "It is indeed a good thing to be here." The other Negro delegates could have echoed that sentiment. Even James G. Barbados, who, en route on the boat trip from Boston, had to walk the deck during a stormy night, his color a bar to a cabin berth. On the final day of the sessions, the delegates ratified the Declaration of Sentiments, a forthright call to action couched in revolutionary language. It had been written the evening before at the home of Delegate James McCrummel, where its chief author, William Lloyd Garrison, was a house guest. Of the 63 signers of the Declaration, the 23-year-old Purvis was destined to live the longest. On the board of managers named by the convention, six Negroes were given seats. The three delegates plus John B. Vachon, Peter Williams of New York, and Abraham D. Shadd of Chester County, Pennsylvania. The founding of an abolitionist society northwide in scope gave a new thrust to the crusade and a fresh hope to Negroes. Within 3 days after the delegates left Philadelphia, a young colored woman, writing under the pen name Ada, sang their praises in verse, concluding with the stanza, "Their works shall live when other deeds which ask a nation's fame have sunk beneath time's whelming wave, unhonored and unnamed." Negroes took part in the organization of affiliates of the New Parent Society. The Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society, successor in 1834 to the New England Anti-Slavery Society, elected James G. Barbados and Joshua Easton of North Bridgewater to its board of counselors. The 12 men who had founded the New England Anti-Slavery Society in January 1832 included no Negroes, but the latter made up one quarter of the signers of the society's constitution, and Samuel Snowden was named on its first panel of counselors. At the initial meeting of the Middletown Anti-Slavery Society in February 1834, Jehiel C. Beeman was a participant, being elected one of its five managers. In October 1835, David Ruggles was among the 400 delegates in attendance at the organizational meeting of the New York Anti-Slavery Society, which had to be moved to Peterborough when a mob occupied its first meeting place, the Supreme Court Chambers at Utica. Seven Negroes took part in the first meeting of the Pennsylvania Anti-Slavery Society, held at Harrisburg in January 1837. As might be expected, this roster included Fortin, Purvis, and McCrummel. Their associates were John C. Bowers and Presbyterian pastor Charles W. Gardner, both of Philadelphia, John Peck, a barbershop owner in Carlisle, and Stephen Smith of East Fallowfield. Smith's partner in a lucrative lumber business, William Whipper, sent word from Columbia expressing regret for his absence. As usual, Negroes were moved by the experience. "I never spent a more agreeable time in my life," wrote Bowers. The high spirits of these pioneers must have been matched by those of clergyman Jehiel C. Beeman when, a year later, he organized a white anti-slavery society at Glastonburg, Connecticut. In the summer of 1838, two branches were organized in Maine, immediately following a visit by Charles Lennox Remond, then a traveling agent for the parent body. The new abolitionism was characterized by the organization of women's auxiliaries, and in this effort, too, Negroes took part. Women had attended the organizational meeting of the American Anti-Slavery Society in Philadelphia, where they had been urged to form their own auxiliaries. They had not been invited to sign the Declaration of Sentiments or to join the society. But even to invite them to become abolitionists was somewhat in advance of the times. Public opinion held that reformist activity was defeminizing and that a woman reformer had somehow unsexed herself. The shout, "Go home and spin," often greeted a woman on the public platform. But the spinning wheel was being replaced, giving women time for something other than household work. With the coming of the abolition movement, many budding women's writers found an outlet for their energies. Hence, the invitation from the new national organization was quickly seized upon. On December 14, 1833, the Female Anti-Slavery Society of Philadelphia had its birth, with Lucretia Mott its guiding spirit. Mrs. Mott later recalled that at the opening meeting, the women, lacking experience in parliamentary procedures, had called upon James McCrummel for assistance. The best known of the four Negro signers of the Society's charter was Sarah M. Douglas, the Quaker principal of the preparatory department of the Institute for Colored Youth, where she doubled as teacher of reading. The three other Negroes were sisters, Harriet Purvis, wife of Robert Purvis, Sarah Fortin, and Margaretta Fortin, the last chosen by the Society as recording secretary. 7 days earlier, the sisters had received a moving tribute in poetry to the daughters of James Fortin from John Greenleaf Whittier, as colorblind in looking at a person as in peering at a painting. Founded also in 1833, indeed antedating the Philadelphia Society by 2 months, was the Boston Female Anti-Slavery Society. One of its five counselors was young Susan Paul, whose brother Thomas was an apprentice in the Liberator office and later a graduate of Dartmouth. At the annual fairs, a money-raising scheme originated by the Boston women, Miss Paul invariably superintended one of the tables. Early in 1837, the Boston Society initiated an exchange of letters with kindred organizations, a step which led to the first anti-slavery convention of American women. Gathering in New York in May from 10 states were more than 100 delegates, among them Sarah M. Douglas and Sarah Fortin. Two particular friends of Miss Douglas were present, Sarah M. Grimke and Angelina E. Grimke. Carolina-born aristocrats turned Quakers, Sarah and Angelina left Charleston in the late 1820s to come north and bear witness against slavery and for women's rights. At the convention, each of the sisters delivered a strong address, both published by vote of the delegates. Sarah's Address to Free Colored Americans and Angelina's Appeal to the Women of the Nominally Free States. The convention also issued a circular bearing a poem by Sarah Fortin calling upon women to abandon race prejudice. At the second anti-slavery convention of the American women, held in Philadelphia in May 1838, Susan Paul was chosen as one of the vice presidents and Sarah M. Douglas as treasurer. Grace Douglas and Harriet Purvis attended the convention, which had to hold its final session in a schoolroom, a mob having burned down its Pennsylvania Hall meeting site. Undaunted by intimidation, Sarah Grimke sponsored a resolution calling upon American women to treat Negroes on the basis of social equality, to appear with them in public places, and to exchange home visits. The third of the Women's National Anti-Slavery Conventions, held also in Philadelphia and in May, met at the Pennsylvania Riding School, no better place being available for so unpopular a gathering. Again, two Negroes were given office, Sarah M. Douglas being continued as treasurer and Grace Douglas, her mother, receiving a vice presidency. The mayor of the city urged the women to hold no meetings in the evening, to avoid unnecessary walking in public with colored people, and to close their convention as soon as possible. The delegates countered by drafting an appeal to American women on prejudice against color, a plea to roll back the tide of racial bias. "It is worth coming all the way from Massachusetts to see what I see here," said Clarissa C. Lawrence, president of the Colored Female Religious and Moral Society of Salem. The convention of 1839 was the last held by the women, the time having come for their admission to the hitherto all-male societies. The participation of colored men and women in the formation of the new national societies was a natural development. Negroes were abolition-minded, having already formed organizations to that end. The Massachusetts General Colored Association dated back to 1826. The Colored Convention movement, bringing together Negro leaders from several northern states, began in 1830, and the Female Anti-Slavery Society of Salem, made up of females of color, was organized on February 22, 1832. From the beginning, the American Anti-Slavery Society vigorously pushed the formation of auxiliary branches, thus giving momentum to the movement among Negroes. In 1834, Negro anti-slavery societies were formed in Rochester, Newark, Nantucket, and Lexington, Massachusetts, the last taking the name Lexington Abolition Society of Colored Persons and Whites Who Feel Desirous to Join. In the same year, the Colored Female Anti-Slavery Society of Middletown, headed by Clarissa Beeman, was organized. 6 colored auxiliaries to the National Society were founded in 1836, including one at Troy, Michigan, plus a woman's anti-slavery group in Rochester. During the following year, Negroes in New York organized the Roger Williams Baptist Anti-Slavery Society as an auxiliary to the national body, and the Negroes in Geneva formed an affiliate of the New York Anti-Slavery Society. In May 1838, black Philadelphians organized the Levitt Anti-Slavery Society, named after the white abolitionist editor Joshua Levitt. Negroes of a tender age shared in the abolitionist crusade from the beginning. To enlist the sympathies and support of the children was an important phase of most of the reform movements in pre-Civil War America. "Our enterprise is a school for the young," wrote the editor of an abolitionist book for children. The Slave's Friend, a monthly designed for juveniles and carrying pictures, hymns, and anecdotes, was distributed without charge. The formation of juvenile anti-slavery societies began in 1834, one of them a girls' group at Providence. The 6 founders quickly added to their number, bringing in several colored misses, making it a sugar plum society, said one observer. At their weekly meetings, one member would read aloud from anti-slavery publications while the others sewed. From the sale of their needlework, the young women raised $90 the first year, sending it to the National Society. Negro young people felt a similar urge to unite for a worthwhile cause. In Boston in 1833, they formed the Juvenile Garrison Independent Society. Youngsters of both sexes and between the ages of 10 and 20 who paid an entrance fee of 4 cents. Almost at the same time, Susan Paul recruited a Garrison Junior Choir, which sang at abolitionist gatherings and gave concerts for the benefit of the Mashpee Indians and similar charities. At a Negro school in Albany in 1834, an anti-slavery club was formed, each member pledging himself to give 6 cents a month to the national body. Perhaps the first true Negro juvenile abolitionist societies were formed in 1838, when 4 of them emerged at Pittsburgh, Troy, Carlisle, and Providence. The first of these, in point of time, was the Pittsburgh Juvenile Anti-Slavery Society, formed on July 7, 1838. With David Peck as president and George Vachon, son of Garrison's friend, as secretary, the Pittsburgh group comprised the first cent-a-week society west of the Alleghenies. The 40 members also raised money for the Colored American, a reformist weekly, and listened to declamations from their fellows. The Juvenile Society at Carlisle also supported the Colored American, and the Providence young people gave their assessments of a penny a week to the national organization. In 1839, the Salem Juvenile Colored Sewing Society, another of the early clubs of its kind, paid $15 to the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society for a life membership for an admired adult. The founding of all Negro societies did not lead to any substantial withdrawal of Negroes from integrated societies. Indeed, many Negroes were opposed to all black auxiliaries, holding that they tended to perpetuate the very evils, prejudice, and discrimination they avowedly sought to combat. In truth, however, the Negro abolition societies did not reflect a go-it-alone philosophy on the part of the founders. Doubtless, some of them had felt that they would be more at ease and under less of a strain in a racially separate group. Others may have preferred for a time a Negro society in order to spare their white abolitionist colleagues any embarrassment or hostility that their presence might incur. But whatever their reason, the founders of Negro societies did not envision their efforts as distinctive or self-contained. Rather, they viewed their role as that of a true auxiliary, supportive, supplemental, and subsidiary. Negro abolitionists spoke with the same accents as their white counterparts, although perhaps in a voice of differing pitch. Negro participants, fittingly enough perhaps, formed a more integral component of the abolition crusade than of any other major reform in America. The larger and far more influential body of Negro abolitionists who never joined a colored anti-slavery society would, as a natural consequence, work closely with whites. But much the same was true for members of the Negro societies, which in their outlook and operations were closely tied in to the larger movement. This reciprocal, interlocking relationship between black and white reformers may be demonstrated by the support, financial and otherwise, each gave to the other in pursuit of the common goal. "We do not wish to be burdensome to any, but we are poor," wrote Congregational clergyman Amos G. Berry, in hardly an original vein. Despite their circumstances, some Negroes managed to give for the slave. In the three spring months of 1833, Negroes contributed to the New England Anti-Slavery Society $41 of the total receipts of $324. In August, the Society received $4 from a Negro church in New Bedford and $23 from one in Philadelphia. 2 months later, the Society received $15 apiece from Philip A. Bell, Susan Paul, and John Remond for life memberships. In the month of November 1834, Negro groups from 12 cities or towns sent $128 to the National Society, about one-seventh of its receipts, $859, for the period. In 1836, Negro groups in Boston and New York gave $81 and $246, respectively, to the Society. Group giving by Negro societies, churches, and Sunday schools was supplemented by individual contributions. Negroes like John B. Vachon and Peter Williams, an Episcopalian clergyman, could send $10, and a less affluent giver, like Coffin Pitts of Boston, might part with $6. John Jones, who died in Philadelphia in September 1834, bequeathed $340 to the Pennsylvania Society, and 4 years later, William Williams left $287 to the Massachusetts Anti-Slavery Society. Over a 13-year period, the lumberyard owner, William Whipper, gave $1,000 annually to the cause. But an offering from a Negro was more likely to be of the genus widow's mite. Small givers predominated, like the girl from Glastonbury, Connecticut, who sent $1 to the Parent Society in 1836. Negro donations were not large, but they came during the crucial beginning years, when fewer white men of means had been converted to the cause, and hence when money was scarcest. Moreover, giving by Negroes had a salutary effect on the white abolitionists, spurring them on. James G. Birney, writing from the National Anti-Slavery Office in New York in May 1838 to a Southern congressman, boasted that among the contributors to their treasury that year was a colored woman who makes her subsistence by selling apples in the streets of this city. Similarly, the support Negroes gave to the anti-slavery journals in the early years of the Crusade had a morale-building effect on their white co-workers. Negroes felt a continuing interest in the welfare of Garrison's Weekly. In January 1835, they organized the Colored Liberator Aiding Association, which drafted an appeal addressed to the free colored citizens of the United States. Negroes supported the Liberator's predecessor, the genius of universal emancipation. Its editor, Benjamin Lundy, was not a New School abolitionist, strictly speaking, but he was second to none in unflagging continuous labor in the cause. In October 1829, The Rights of All, the only Negro weekly of its day, urged its readers to subscribe to the genius on the grounds that its principles were rare, sacred, and dear. In 1832, John B. Vachon acted as an agent for the paper. In June of the following year, a national convention of Negroes, meeting at Bethel Church in Philadelphia, voted to extend the patronage of five reformist sheets, those of Garrison and Lundy, plus the Emancipator, the Abolitionist, and the Genius of Temperance. Organ of the American Anti-Slavery Society until 1840, the Emancipator had five Negro agents in 1834: David Ruggles, John Peck, Abraham D. Shadd, Stephen Smith, and Vachon. Their job to obtain subscriptions and collect arrearages. Of these, the most zealous by far was Ruggles, general agent for New York City, who published a series of six articles explaining to Negroes their stake in the success of the paper. When the Herald of Freedom was launched, James Fortin sent $5 to its editor, N.P. Rogers, accompanied by a note, "I should like to have some instructions as to future remittances." Stephen Myers of Albany, in a letter addressed to the general public in December 1842, listed the papers that should be supported: the Liberator, the Anti-Slavery Standard, the Emancipator and Free American, the Western Citizen, and the Charter Oak. The efforts of Negro abolitionists brought a reciprocal response from their white colleagues, a response that took many forms. Not to be outdone, white abolitionists supported Negro journals, dating back to 1827, when the National Convention and the Pennsylvania Society recommended Freedom's Journal. In 1837, the Executive Committee of the American Anti-Slavery Society recommended the Colored American to its members, and at the annual meeting of the Society the following year, slips of paper were circulated to obtain the names of those who wished to become subscribers. Local organizations took up collections for the weekly, among them the New York State Anti-Slavery Society and the Massachusetts Female Emancipation Society. "I must occasionally send you a few dollars towards sustaining your excellent paper," wrote Gerrit Smith on August 22, 1837, to Samuel Cornish, editor of the Colored American, enclosing $10 and adding, "The Lord bless you." The Northern Star and Freeman's Advocate, a small, short-lived sheet published in Albany, had 213 white subscribers in January 1843, making up at least half of the total. Abolitionist newspapers carried addresses made by Negroes, a long speech often appearing in installments. The Liberator carried an address by Robert Bridges Fortin, son of James, to the Female Anti-Slavery Society of Philadelphia in November 1834. The Herald of Freedom gave three-quarters of a front page to an address by J. McCune Smith at the annual meeting of the National Society in 1838. Then 24, Smith held 3 degrees from the University of Glasgow, Bachelor and Master of Arts and Doctor of Medicine. At the annual meeting the next year, the speech given by Andrew Harris, an 1838 graduate of the University of Vermont, was carried in the Herald of Freedom. Similarly, a year later, the Anti-Slavery Standard printed in full the address given by Henry Highland Garnet, which drew tears from almost every eye, although Garnet was still a student at Oneida Institute at Whiteboro, New York. The speeches by Negroes at the conventions illustrate another service provided by the white abolitionists, that of providing a sounding board. Negro speakers could air the grievances of their black fellows. They could advise well-wishers who were seeking ways of helping them, and they could, like one speaker, call attention to the numerous falsifications of history for the purpose of concealing the merits of his people. In similar vein, the mulatto school teacher, C.V. Caples, gave his fellow reformers a terse reading of the ancient past. What built up Athens? What extended Rome? The learning and the arts which came from colored men. Who built the pyramids? Colored men. Who humbled Rome itself? Hannibal, a colored man. Spurred by the convention speeches of black participants, the editors of the abolitionist press began to look afresh at the Negro, offering a counterpoise to the daily papers which seldom included him except in the crime columns. Abolitionist weeklies carried original poems by Negroes, some of them signed anonymously by a colored lady or by a colored girl 10 years of age. Two abolitionist weeklies carried the fine piece, Orators and Orations, an address by William G. Allen at Central College, McGrawville, New York, where he was professor of rhetoric and belles lettres. At some time or another, an abolitionist weekly would reprint stanzas from Phyllis Wheatley, along with the bittersweet story of her life, and less often something from the works of George M. Horton, most likely the lines, "Alas, and am I born for this, to wear this slavish chain, deprived of all created bliss, through hardship, toil, and pain?" The military role of the Negro was not neglected in the abolitionist press. John Greenleaf Whittier, Quaker and pacifist though he was, contributed two such articles to the abolitionist journals, The Black Soldiers of the Revolution and The Black Men of the Revolution and the War of 1812. Abolitionist publications took due note of Negroes who were successful in business or professional life. They extolled J.B. Smith of Boston as the Prince of Caterers. Readers of the anti-slavery press might learn of attorney Macon B. Allen of the Portland Bar, or of John V. DeGrasse, graduate in medicine from Bowdoin College, who had spent 2 years in London and Paris hospitals and had made several trips across the Atlantic as a ship surgeon before settling in Boston. In September 1834, the Liberator requested Negro inventors to write to the paper so that it could assist them in obtaining patents and also furnish them with proof of colored talent and ability. Abolitionist newspapers carried advertisements of Negroes who ran clothing or grocery shops, invariably adding an editorial note that the proprietor of the establishment was richly deserving of the patronage extended to him. Some advertisements came from owners of lodging houses, invariably Negroes themselves, who had rooms for the accommodation of genteel persons of color. Abolitionist newspapers carried letters to the editor praising this or that Negro in business or the professionals. Thomas Jennings, a surgeon dentist of Boston, for example, received such unbilled advertising. The abolitionist press had a marked effect in making Negroes more active in social and civic affairs. Negro organizations felt no hesitancy in asking these newspapers to carry notices of their coming meetings and lists of their officers. At many Negro meetings, the final order of business was a motion instructing the secretary to send a copy of the proceedings to a specified list of journals. Brief notices of Negro weddings dotted the back pages of abolitionist weeklies. How warming to the self-esteem to see one's name in print! But more important was the sense of civic participation it engendered. As they prepared to organize a state society in the fall of 1838, the abolitionists who assembled at Milton in Wayne County, Indiana, read a sobering letter from Gamaliel Bailey. Bailey was editor of the Cincinnati Philanthropist, the first anti-slavery journal in the West, whose office had been the target of mobs on 3 occasions. "Your troubles are yet to come, and they may indeed be fiery," wrote Bailey. This book is continued on Cassette 2, Side 1.
Well, there we have it, Chapter 2 from the book The Abolitionist by Benjamin Quarles. I'd like to remind our listeners they can call in with questions and comments at 347-324-5552. My name is Preston Washington. Has anyone else joined us here on the Gift of Freedom? Okay, a lot of history there. A lot going on in that chapter 2. I was quite moved by the involvement of the women establishing their own societies and what they were up against. Some sexism going on there, being taunted by go home and sew, but yet they still involve themselves in the movement. I was impressed and learned a lot about the newspapers or the weeklies involved in the abolitionist movement, the Freedom's Journal, the Colored American, the Herald of Freedom, along with the Liberator, etc. Also, what struck me was the involvement of the juveniles and female juveniles, the girls, starting their juvenile abolitionist movements. Kind of reminded me, I was thinking of the movement during the 60s, so the 50s and 60s, and how the children, school children, were very much involved in the South in terms of marches and sit-ins. The four young girls that gave up their life in the bombing of the Birmingham, Alabama church, et cetera, just seemed to be an extension of what was going on back in the early 1800s in terms of the black abolitionist movement. I was also struck to learn a little bit more about George B. Vachon. I'd heard the name before at several high schools, black high schools named Vachon High School, but I really wasn't aware of the extent of the history of the Vachons. George B. Vachon and his father, John Batten Vachon, was a very important abolitionist back in the day. Excuse me, he was born free in 1792. And he was also a soldier, and he fought in the War of 1812. And by the time he was 20 years of age, he was a seaman aboard the warship USS Revenge. His son, George Boyer Vachon, was the first graduate, I believe, of Oberlin University in Ohio. Not only that, he was a valedictorian of his class. Something else I was struck me was he was the first professor at Harvard University in 1867. And he had been turned down to become a lawyer in the state of New York. But he took the test again, and he passed the New York bar and was New York's first black licensed attorney. George Boyer Vachon. His wife was also involved. Susan Paul Vachon was involved in the movement as well. And she graduated at age 15 from a very distinguished school, Miss O'Meara's Seminary in Somerville, Massachusetts. Graduated at age 16 and valedictorian of her class. And was very involved in early on in the movement with her husband and her father-in-law. And she was from a distinguished family as well. Elijah Smith was her father, and he was an established composer and cornetist. And played. He was summoned to Windsor Castle to play for Queen Victoria. And excuse me again. So quite a bit there, information there in Chapter 2. Some of the names that came about saw some husband and wife teams as well. Robert Purvis, who was a leading abolitionist of the day, along with his wife, Harriet Purvis, who was also heavily involved in the movement. And I want to remind you again, for the listening audience, that if you would like to get involved, you can give us a call here at 347-324-5552. I expect others to join us here for our discussion and conversation relative to the book, The Abolitionist, by Benjamin Quarles. Excuse me again.
Hello, Mr. Preston, can you hear me?
I can hear you now.
Great. Doing a fabulous show. I want to thank you for hosting the show. We're waiting for Ty to join you. He's being held up for some business after hours. He's a very dedicated man. He works with the youth, so he called up to say that he would be a little late. So hopefully he'll join us. But you mentioned some great facts. Can we go over just a few on your list?
Sure, by all means.
Okay. Who were your favorite?
Well, here, the Bashans. John B. Bashan, his son, George Boyer. George's wife. I found that... the history on those three quite fascinating. And more so because George and his wife eventually moved here to Missouri, St. Louis, Missouri. Actually, Susan moved to St. Louis after the death of her husband and volunteered at the All Saints Episcopal Church there in St. Louis, established a book club, Mother's Club, whose purpose was to guide young women in that city. And I went to college with guys and girls who went to Bashan High School there in St. Louis. And for knowing that and not knowing the history, I'm really, really somewhat embarrassed by that. Not understanding the history of the Bashans, and that his father, John, fought in the War of 1812.
Seems as though they were really, the family was deeply involved. I think Bashan was the one who paid for a fugitive. He was part of the Underground Railroad, and he helped pay for the bounty for someone who was kidnapped by a bounty hunter. And after the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850, he remained in the States when many other people had fled because, you know, they were doing so much work, the black abolitionists. What do you think about all these different abolitionist groups that African Americans formed in the 1700s and 1800s?
Well, you know, I was very impressed by that, particularly the aid that they gave to the Liberator, Garrison's paper, and also the fact that they established their own community papers and abolitionist papers, some of which I mentioned, like the Freedom's Journal, the Colored American, the Herald of Freedom, also the interdependence that they had for one another in terms of they were offering patent assistance for black inventors. They were advertising businesses, you know, and that was quite remarkable, I think, for that time. And it's some very serious folk going about pressing for their freedom on all avenues in terms of economics, housing, getting your patent if you were an inventor. They were offering assistance there. So I was very impressed by that.
Can you think of any magazines or publications that can match the things that were being done in the 1700s, 1800s by African-Americans today?
You know, it's a good question. And in thinking of that, and I was thinking of magazines, Ebony probably comes closest. You got Essence Magazine. But a lot of our magazines, particularly after, you know, the Civil Rights Movement, turned more to entertainment. I was in the bookstore today and was looking at magazines like Divide, other magazines that are more focused on entertainment and promoting entertainment. You don't see as many what might be called freedom journals that I'm aware of. There might be some out there. Maybe some of our callers are aware, or listeners are aware of those, and will give us a call at 347-324-5552.
Well, the one magazine I was thinking about is the Black Enterprise. I think they come closest to what our ancestors were doing in the past. What say you?
Exactly, yeah, the business angle, because that was going on in the late 1700s and early 1800s in terms of the business. So, yeah, that is one magazine that's established solely for assisting and aiding and getting information to Black entrepreneurs who are trying to venture into business. Lessons on capital, marketing, etc. That would be one magazine, exactly.
Go ahead.
Oh, I was just thinking about Vashon again. I was just overwhelmed with the information. He was also the solicitor for the Freedmen's Bureau. And he was permitted to argue before the United States Supreme Court. Quite a fellow. And I noticed during the presentation, going through chapter two there, that George Boyer Vashon's name was probably coming up more frequently than any other of the abolitionists during that period, during his period. So, yeah, I was really impressed by that. And John, his father, he had an uncle. George's father was John Vashon, and John Vashon had a brother by the name of Halson, H-A-L-S-O-N, and who resided in Pittsburgh, as they all did. A lot of freedom fighters coming out of the Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania area. But his, when John was en route to a national convention of the Veterans War of 1812, he collapsed and died. Heart failure. And was on his way, still involved in the movement, going to a convention of veterans of the War of 1812. So, yeah, I was very, as you can tell, as you can probably see, very impressed by the Vashons, John and his son George and George's wife, Susan Paul. Now, I'm wondering if Susan Paul, was she related? There was a Nathaniel Paul that was mentioned as an abolitionist as well. Do you know if they were related?
No. I don't think so. I don't know. I didn't do any research on the Vashons. As you mentioned, the father and the son.
Yeah.
But I was really taken back by how they use Black history in their magazines and newspapers. and you talked about Hannibal and things of that nature.
And the pyramids and what was going on in Egypt and Hannibal being a black man, yeah. I was impressed with that, and they were using that history as we do today, as you're doing, as we guessed, who today history will say is the high priestess of black history.
Please.
Today.
I think that's funny. That's a nice compliment. But
been out there every day, you know. It's just not relegated to 1 month out of the year. Day out. Certainly has broadened my...
I enjoy it, you know, considering, you know, how they depict us on TV day in and day out in such a negative way. They even mentioned in the book that, you know, our ancestors had to use their publications to combat all the crime that was being reported, and that's the only thing they would report about African Americans way back then was the crime section. So it's a constant thing. It's not new what's going on today, and we have to go back in history and figure out, and I think these people come from one of the best generations, figure out how they did it and try to emulate what they did to succeed in eradicating slavery. And that's what we're trying to do here, is just to do everything that they did, because they left a very good map to teach us. And we just have to dig it up as if it was a gold coin, and, you know, and with them in mind, do exactly what they did, because we have nothing to fight compared to what they were able to do.
Exactly.
You know, our fights are nowhere near as devastating as slavery. So that's why I do, you know, what I do.
Exactly. You know, and I noticed they weren't bashful about donating their money and raising money. The women having a meeting, half the women would be in the meeting, the other half would be sewing. And the products that they finished, they would sell to raise funds for the movement. So they really weren't bashful about giving their money. I noticed with the women, no concern. Well, some concern, I'm sure, for their safety. But, you know, they had to change a venue there for one of their meetings because it got burned down where their meeting was originally to be held. So, you know, they were quite dedicated, quite committed, although a lot of them were born free. Some of them had to buy their freedom, and who had very meager incomes, who really weren't bashful about donating what little they had. There was a mention of a young lady, I believe, who sent a dollar, along with the statement, "God bless, keep up the work." The youth involved, the risk that they were taking.
And they mentioned a lady was selling apples. That one woman was
selling apples.
You know, so selling apples just to, you know, they were very conscious of the cause. Many say because, you know, a great deal of the free people had relatives still enslaved. So, you know, it was definitely on their minds and on their hearts. And they were really busy. And out of these groups, you know, some people think that the church came first and then these groups were formed. But it seems as though these people, they did all this great work, in essence, you know, living out the saying, "I am my brother's keeper." And from doing that, it seems as though they were able to start form churches and schools and things of that nature. So I was really proud to hear the history behind how the churches were formed, how these anti-slavery organizations started schools and orphanage hospitals. So, you know, it says a lot about who we are and how we live and overcome this struggle.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
any
one of the
comments about how you want, how would you compare the work of the church today and its public relations, the image today compared to this church, the black church of yesteryear?
Want me to walk out on that limb?
Yes.
How the black church?
Are you a member of a church?
No, I'm not. Not a formal member.
Okay. All right. So you're not going out too far. You're, it's not like your minister is going to give you the evil eye on Sunday.
Yeah. I was raised and baptized in the Baptist tradition. And but churches today, I mean, particularly the black church, seems to be focused on the mega church. The mega church. And the small corner church, like the one I was baptized and raised in, have become a thing of the past, or becoming a thing of the past. The involvement, you know, 11 o'clock a.m. on Saturday, Sunday mornings is still the most segregated hour in America to some extent. And I don't know that the involvement of the black church is as meaningful today as it was then. Now, some would say, well, you know, that the pressing need is not here today. I think they would be mistaken. I think the need is just as prevalent today as it's always been. But I think the black church, just from my point of view, is really more about sustaining itself now. I don't really see the interdependence that I was being made aware of in the piece that we heard in Mr. Benjamin Quarles' book, The Abolitionist. I don't know that it's there today as it was back in the day, in the early 1800s. Do you have any particular thoughts on it?
It's amazing to see, you know, how they were, like I said, the men who formed these churches, it's not as if the church picked them, but they built the church. You follow
mm-hmm.
where I'm coming from? Today you hear about churches recruiting ministers, and from what we're learning, it was just the opposite. The ministers built the churches. And I just think it's amazing that, you know, it was the churches evolved from just people, like-minded people doing good work. And from these organizations came the church. And I don't see that as history being continued. And I'm not formally a member as you. But my grandmother, she was an evangelist. She had a church in Patterson, a storefront. You know, that's all I knew from about church. And as a kid, I grew up in a different church. It was a neighborhood. They were very involved with youth programs. And so I did get to see both types of church, white church, black church, Catholic. And I know as a kid, I appreciate the ones who, you know, took the time out to work with, the youth and gave back and asked for it. That's my definition of a church.
Mm-hmm.
You know, one that's constantly helping you.
Mm-hmm. Heavy involvement of the Quaker mm-hmm. church there in Pennsylvania was mm-hmm. heavily involved in the movement. Don't know how involved they are now in the movement, although there were Quakers who were slave owners as well.
Mm-hmm. Well, I know in this book, I don't think they mentioned the slave owners, but what we talked about last week was Paul Cuffey was a black Quaker. And a few people they mentioned in this chapter, I was trying to find some more information on them. They were also black Quakers. They said they couldn't sit in the same area like most of the white churches did back in the day. It was segregated within the church. But I was surprised to learn there were so many black Quakers.
Yeah, you know, some of the people that were mentioned there were of mixed ancestry. Mr. Purvis, I think his grandfather was kidnapped from Morocco, who was making him a Moor. His wife, Harriet, her father was, I believe, a German Jewish immigrant.
I think that's funny. You know, I noticed that in history, whenever there's something extremely positive about black people, they dissect their lineage and their ethnicity. But when they commit a crime, they don't dissect their lineage. They're just black. Black man, black woman committed so-and-so crime. And I've had conversations about that with Obama being the president. Everyone wants to make sure it's clear that he has a white mom and black father, but when he's being pulled over or if he was arrested, that would never be an issue. He would be a black man. So when I talk about black history, I'm clear to make sure that I don't make any distinctions, because if it was a negative report, there wouldn't be any made. So I try to be consistent on this show. Say you're black. Black is black. And if you want to make distinctions, if you want to be part Cherokee, part German, this is not the show. This is a black history show. And that's what we celebrate. Other shows in the media, when it's a positive story, they will make sure that their part is recognized. So, you know, that's why I read it all the time. That the Purvis, and they describe, even in this book, they describe him as being a very light-colored African-American, that nature. But when it comes to slavery, he would have been enslaved too.
Oh, yeah.
And probably was. So I think we shouldn't fall into that trap, giving credit to their success as being related to their ethnicity or their diverse background. I think we're all motivated to do the good work because we all have the common enemy, common struggles, and discrimination doesn't, racism doesn't discriminate, especially back then when it was about labor. But any other points you want to raise before we end this show? I'm still looking for Ty to come on, but I don't think he's going to make it.
Yeah, I don't see that she's going to make it right now. I'm going over my notes here. One had to write pretty fast, but like I said, there was a lot of information.
Oh, yes. I mean, he was piling it up on great information. We can't even do justice to any of these chapters in our little 45-minute discussion.
Well, here again, those interdependence, mm-hmm. the linkages that were Lucretia Mott, for example, she and William Purvis fought together, organized together, and he was very supportive of black women and their movement and what they were all about. And in fact, I think he was a founder or co-founder of the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Society. I think I got that note right. So,
You said Mott? Lucretia Mott?
Well,
She was white.
Lucretia Mott.
Lucretia Mott is a white lady. She's featured in William Steele's book, and a lot of these black abolitionists can be found in William Steele's book, The Underground Railroad. He has illustrations of them. That's how I first learned of Lucretia. She's out of New Jersey, where I'm from, Burlington County. Her family has a long lineage of abolitionist work. The Mott family, they even had visits in New Jersey. They're still running a foundation for grants and everything. I think out of Detroit, yes, with the cars. They had a company, they became very wealthy in Newark, New Jersey. And then when the Ford Motor Company came about, they moved to Detroit. And the Mott family was incredibly involved with the Underground Railroad in Jersey. Yes. Yeah. Purvis, who else was mentioned in this chapter? And you said the women. Yeah, like, go ahead.
James G. Barbados was mentioned. Peter Williams. William Logan. Nathaniel Paul.
Many of those people I couldn't find on the internet yet. When I did research, I couldn't find too much about them. I was able to find Henry Highland Garnett. He was mentioned several times in the book. He was an anti-slavery organizer. And did you notice how many different organizations they formed?
Yeah, I was, again, I was impressed, not only with the organizations that came along with the newspapers that they were forming, and the involvement of the women. The women formed quite a number of abolitionist groups.
Oh, and when you mention the women, I think the women, and I had this is just a thought, I haven't proved it yet, but all of the knitting that they did, I think it has a lot to do with the quilts, Underground Railroad quilts. When you read about the narratives about the escape, African Americans wanted to escape from slavery, when they would reach certain destinations, they made sure that they were given bedding, as they call it, bedding, all the time. And I think that bedding included quilts, and they had bazaars. They held annual bazaars to raise money.
Mm-hmm.
And these bazaars also promoted free made goods instead of slave made goods. They boycotted slave made goods. So when you hear about different boycotts from the 60s, boycotts were taking place back in the 1700s with the first anti-slavery movements. Mm-hmm. Silk was preferred over cotton. And as we move on in the book, you'll hear them saying different speeches talking about how we shouldn't be using sugar and how they should go a couple more doors down to buy free-made goods. So they were intense, much more so than what we would ever be taught in school and what's being taught right now in school.
Now, you mentioned we'll be going further in the book. Is there something you would want to tell our listeners about next week's program?
Next week, a little bit of chapter 2, and then most of it is chapter 3. Do you have notes on chapter 3? I have Elijah, Lovejoy, different attacks on black fugitives and different people fighting. I think it's about the black and white abolitionist relationships, because I think it starts to become more militant. The blacks
become more militant?
Right.
And do the whites then shy away?
Right. I think we're going to be talking about how in the South slave revolts caused the white abolitionists in the South to you know, withdraw their support. And this, you know, this causes a split. And this is the first time that Lloyd Garrison, William Lloyd Garrison,
mm-hmm.
from the Liberator, this is the first time there's some dissension between people that want to follow him and a new militant type of abolitionist movement that's starting to emerge. So it's really good. I hope people will tune in. And I find that many people, when they call, they don't want to talk. They're very shy. And that's a good thing. And we just ask that that you call in, I mean, not call in, that you log on at www.blackhistoryblog.com and share it, download the shows with iTunes. You can put it on CD if you're a teacher. Please listen to Benjamin Crowell's book. We have the book uploaded for just 1 week per chapter, and then we take the chapter down on our other channel, which is www.blogtalkradio.com/blackhistory. You can hear the chapters, each chapter every week, without any interruptions or any conversation that you're listening to now. And that's just I want to thank everyone for listening and sharing and visiting our Facebook pages. What is your Facebook page, Preston?
Preston Washington, Kansas City. You can friend me that way on Facebook.
And I'm on Facebook at Leslie, L-E-S-L-E-Y, Gist, that's G-I-S-T, Facebook, and I don't have much information on there, so you should be able to find me with that name, Leslie Gist. And we're having a fabulous time talking and learning about our history, Black abolitionists. And there's one other thing, I just learned that there's a movie coming out on PBS. Did you see that?
Is that the abolitionist?
Right.
Yeah. Exactly. I did see a trailer on that.
Mm-hmm. So I'm excited about seeing that. Are you going to see it? Do you plan on looking at it?
That's going to be on PBS, right?
Correct.
Yeah.
Right. So
if it's PBS, I'll more likely see it.
Mm-hmm.
I don't have the date, but I'll look that up. Maybe post it on my
Facebook. Let me see if I can tell you really quickly the date. The Philadelphia Museum is having a screening on December 20th. That's tonight.
That's tonight.
Right. So we're missing it. And then it'll be aired on PBS on January 8th.
January 8th.
And their movie is going to, or their documentary is going to feature Frederick Douglass, William Lloyd Garrison, and Harriet Beecher Stowe, John Brown, and Angela Grimke. Tell us a little bit about Harriet Beecher Stowe.
Well, what I know very little about her, except that she wrote, did she write Uncle Tom's Cabin?
Yes, and that's what she's known for. And this book is going to talk about it, and they're having a problem. The Black abolitionists, especially the militant abolitionists, are upset that the main character migrates to Africa, goes back to Africa. And you'll see that's a reoccurring theme throughout this book. There's a fight for the abolitionists, Black abolitionists, to remain here in the United States and not to be forced back to Africa. Do you have any comments about why, or thoughts why they would not want to go back to Africa by force, or why they would even, why the white slavers would even devise a scheme?
Well, by that time, they had no, you know, no real remembrance of Africa.
Mm-hmm.
no real connection, I would believe, to Africa within their heart and soul. Now, they might have heard things about Africa from the older folk, but a lot of that history had been lost. The language had been lost. Tribal affiliation, country affiliation had been lost. Religious ties had been lost. So going back there, not knowing who your family, you know, not having any family there, the family that you know within a generation or two are here in the States. So,
well, and, you know, this was an organization formed by slaveholders, and it was called a colonization society. Yes, and they had two places they wanted to force these troublemaking abolitionists to live. They wanted to send them to Liberia or Sierra Leone. And they were sick of them and their literature. And they burned down city and post offices trying to keep pamphlets like David Walker's pamphlets out of the reach of their slaves or the enslaved in the South. So this was causing wreaking havoc on their business. People were escaping through the Underground Railroad without a labor force. They couldn't continue their business. They couldn't make a profit. They were so desperate that the slave insurance couldn't cover what these black abolitionists were doing to their business in the North. And they were bold. You know, Frederick Douglass, you got to admit that he was pretty bold. He was an escapee himself. And he was out there publicly talking about how he escaped and how he wanted all others, other enslaved people to escape. Any comments about, you know, these abolitionists that were speaking on these lecture circuits going all over the world, not just in America, but they were everywhere, raising money and awareness about the condition of their brethren.
And they probably received a lot of sympathy overseas is another reason to do that.
And money.
And money, yeah.
Mm-hmm.
It was certainly catch as catch can here in the United States, I'm sure, particularly as more militant the movement became. The dollars would dry up from those from the predominant society that were prone to support. So they were probably forced to go outside.
Their scheme didn't work and the blacks didn't go by force, they devised another plan called the Fugitive Slave Law, which they were able to attain assistance through the federal government. And with this assistance, they were able to target these black abolitionists. And this caused them to leave voluntarily to places like Canada, you know, because now they could be arrested. Everyone knew who they were. So they were in the spotlight in the Fugitive Slave Law of 1850.
Have you heard anything about the involvement of blacks in France that the abolitionists here might have formed some alliances with?
That's a great question. I would think so, because the Harlem Renaissance was so close to, you know, France and Paris and, you know, that whole European thing. And they did abolish slavery before the Americas, you know, before the United States. So there was a connection. I know I want to go visit for sure. We have a Facebook friend who runs a black tourist company. And I wish she was on the line because she could definitely tell us the history.
Because a lot of those French folk wound up in Haiti. And I think one of the first, I don't know what they were called, lieutenant generals or whatever, that Bonaparte sent out was a black man, sent him to Haiti. I guess old Trooper, I can't pronounce his name, you know who I'm talking about? Louis Ouverture, the Frenchman.
Okay. Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering what the involvement, I'm going to have to look into that.
Well, it had to be really serious for them to design the Statue of Liberty. Wasn't that the country?
Yeah, that's the story, yeah.
Mm-hmm. So I also have on my Facebook page a picture of a statue that they used in the exposition, Centennial Exposition.
I was going to say that I read somewhere that the statue that's there in New York is not the original statue. The original statue was made after the likeness of a black female, from what I hear.
Well, it's a great point you're raising because, you know, students are being taught about the transatlantic slave trade, but they're not being taught about the international anti-slavery movement.
Mm-hmm.
And in respect to who abolished slavery first and last throughout the world. And I think that's important, and that's our responsibility to do this research, to teach our youngsters. And I just recently learned that one of these abolitionists featured in the book started an organization that had oversight over the curriculums, and he made sure that the curriculum was fit and proper for African-American students. And I'm trying to find the name of this organization. His name was Mr. Charles L. Reason, and he felt that, you know, it was our obligation to see to it that our students, our children, we're getting properly educated. Do you know of any organization similar to that today?
No, I don't. Not personally, I don't. But I can certainly start looking for some. Well, here in Kansas City, you have the W.E. Du Bois Center, which is really focused on educating black youth. And putting the truth out of black history. So I guess I got to take that back. The W.E. Du Bois Learning Center. And I'm sure in most major cities there are similar organizations, such as the W.E. Du Bois Learning Center here in Kansas City. I'm sure you have them in New York. I think what's the museum there in Harlem?
You're talking about the Schomburg?
Yeah, Schomburg. I'm sure they have some programs going on there.
Well, this is what he did in 1847. Reason and Charles B. Ray founded the Society for the Promotion of Education Among Colored Children, a black organization authorized by the state legislature to oversee black schools in New York City.
Mm-hmm.
Very deep. I think it's incredible. And we can say today we have something called the Amistad Committee, which is in New Jersey. It's headed up by Stephanie Wilson, and she does a great job. She also hosted a few of the Freedom screenings. We did the Slavery by Another Name.
Oh, yeah.
Black Men's Book.
Douglas Barton.
Right. And Sam Pollard. Director, he was the featured guest. He was on the panel. So she does a phenomenal job in New Jersey with teaching history teachers, primarily history teachers, how to infuse black history into the everyday curriculum, not just during Black History Month, which is a new federal law that all schools in the United States have to infuse black history in their history curriculums. So So that's something very similar to what Mr. Regan did in 1847. Mm-hmm. All right, so we can end the show with that. And I want to thank you for being here. And you've been working with the Vista Freedom and helping me out for a few months. And I can always count on you. And before we go, just give the listeners your information.
Okay, my email address is prewas@gmail.com. And you can hook up with me on Facebook, Preston, Washington, Kansas City, Southeast High School. I think I'm the only Preston, Washington on Facebook, but maybe not. I think I'll have to check that. And it's always a pleasure, Leslie. I'm glad that you invited me on tonight. Never get too old to learn.
Say it again?
Never get too old to learn.
Oh, that's so true. Well, I want to say thank you, and with that, we'll have a good night, and hopefully we'll be listening, and we'll be on for you guys to listen to us next Thursday night.
Okay. Take care.
All right.
All right. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Thank you.